Hello and welcome back to Cooking the Books with me, Jilly Smith, the podcast which takes us through four food moments from the books of our favourite food writers. It's about all of life through the prism of food. And this week we're popping over to the windy old Clare Valley just outside Adelaide to catch up with food writer, TV presenter, sustainable living advocate, urban farmer, entrepreneur and the queen of granny skills, Rebecca Sullivan, to talk about her book, First Nations Food Companion.
I remember in the first seasons of Australian MasterChef where there was nothing, you know, and then all of a sudden maybe one season one person might use a token bit of wattle seed and then, you know, it started creeping in. But what Jock did when he became the judge of MasterChef was, I believe, made it part of his contract that there would be native food in every single episode.
I first met Rebecca back in 2016 at a conference at the University of California in Berkeley about the role of food in the health of, well, everything that we care about on the planet. I'd written a lot about Australia over the years by then, but what she told me over several glasses of wine one evening about the epiphany that led to the creation of her First Nations food company, Wandoo, blew my mind.
So my aha moment was working in the food industry for a good part of a decade, moving back to Australia, meeting my partner Damien, and realising that I'd never tried anything local. And by way of local, I mean, like, this is a girl who stands on a soapbox and tells everyone that would listen to them to eat local, eat local, eat local, eat sustainably, eat local. But I'd never tried lemon myrtle, didn't know what wattle seed was. And I always say this and people laugh, but I'd had kangaroo once when my Parisian friends forced me to eat it. And I had this just, so Damien, for context, my partner Damien is First Nations. So he's an Adnimatha man from the Flinders Ranges in South Australia. And meeting him just really opened my mind and has put me on a journey to decolonize the plate.
I mean, that is exactly what you're doing. And, you know, where we met was a real sort of a hub of fantastic food innovation and thinking. You know, ideas were popping all over the place. But this is not you being trendy, is it? You know, Indigenous Aboriginal foods have been on the plate in Australia since the 60s. And you told me then that it was a bit of a trendy thing. This is different, isn't it? What's the difference between what happened then and what's happening now?
The reality is that our First Nations people have been eating these food for 65,000 plus years. And you don't, as a people, continue to be the longest continuous culture in the world if you're not eating bloody good food, right? If food isn't your medicine, if food isn't your, like, part of everything that you do and be. And I just think that what's changed dramatically is that people are, I hope, becoming more connected to culture generally. People's eyes are open to Aboriginal culture a lot more. We're a lot more aware of the fact that eating sustainably means eating locally. And if we're going to eat local, then how can you possibly ignore the foods from your own back garden? Coinciding with a superfoods trend. And when you look at all the superfoods of the world, Australia has easily the most of them. You know, we already know that we've got the highest source of vitamin C in Kakadu plum in our own back garden. We know that our native pepper is high in antioxidants. We know that our plums are triple what a plum, you know, from England would be. We know these things for the most part. It was also people being called out on the tokenism of using native food. I think people were starting to get called out on being lazy and just putting it on when they could be bothered finding it, you know. And that was great journalism, you know. That was great media actually going, well, come on, guys. You know, you can't just put a leaf of Warragul green on a plate and say you support Aboriginal Australia. You can't just, you know, do it once a year during NAIDOC week and think that you're part of the big picture. You have to go further. And for me, it was people like, is still people like Ben Shuri at Attica, who has always made the effort to maintain a menu that is largely native ingredients. It's come down to, yeah, a beautiful, I guess, collision of lots of things happening. Black Lives Matter, you know, so many things have happened that have allowed First Nations food to be at the forefront.
Fast forward, you know, to 2024, and you have created a whole business around this with Damien, your partner. And it is a cultural education process, but it is also about products. I mean, I've got some green ants that you gave me on a popover trip to London. Still haven't quite used them. In fact, that's one of your food moments, isn't it? We're going to talk about how and why we should eat green ants. And, you know, you do, what you do, freeze dry them or something, and you put them in packets that people can buy online. Yeah. And you've got a whole load of products now that are flying off the shelf. You've also got a lot of these indigenous products into the gin distilleries and onto the menus in some of the top restaurants in Australia. I mean, it's a phenomenal feat, isn't it? So that's what, 7 years since we had that conversation in Berkeley, 8 years, actually. You know, all the stuff that you were just talking about, the kind of the political, the cultural, the soul need to actually embrace your own culture and to understand what your own story is. What's that done for you personally?
Gosh, I mean, what's it done for me? Well, for one, in all honesty, you know, this is me being completely honest here. It made me want to have children. I mean, I didn't want to have children. But I'm now so determined to leave a world where my kids grow up being proud of being First Nations, of being Indigenous Australian, and hopefully continue the legacy that we've started to create. You know, we're only going to ever sow the seeds in our lifetime. We're never going to reap the rewards. But being part of an industry, and I hope we've assisted in helping to grow an industry, you know, before I met Damien, kids weren't something I saw as being part of my future, but they definitely are now. We've got two beautiful boys, Mali and Nari, and they drive us forward to continue to work in an industry that has been hard. Like, it's been really hard because we're not just going out there and selling beautiful products. We have to sell an entire new way of thinking, an entire new way of purchasing, an entire new blockchain, so food system. We have to be involved in the entire system. We can't just call up a wholesaler and go, hey, I need 50 kilos of David Plum. Can you help me out here? We have to support new growers to come into the industry, try and encourage people to become part of the industry, try and get chefs to use it. Because it's all an effort. It's still the same as other industries were 30 years ago, you know. I mean, I always think back to when aubergines, you know, weren't even in a supermarket. When aubergines or eggplants first came to Australia or America or the UK, you know, people were like, what the hell is this? You know, we're sort of there, but a little bit further down the track now.
Yeah. When you talk about the kids, I mean, one of the first lines in the book is about Mali eating food from country with his hands. Yeah. And you say there's an opportunity to tell stories about his mixed heritage, the oppressor and the indigenous. I mean, how do you, because you're the oppressor and Damien is the indigenous. I mean, how do you, you're doing good stuff, Bex, but you know, how do you tell that story to your boys?
Oh, that's a really good one. I mean, my sons, like Mali in particular, you know, he goes to daycare as a 3.5, well, nearly 4-year-old now, takes kwandong, which is our native peach, takes bags of it, shares it with his mates and goes, I'm Adna Mutna, here, have some of my kwandongs. You know, and these are like a really sour, almost like an unripe peach. And you watch the daycare teachers go, oh no, they're not going to like that. They're not going to like that. It's too sour. But the great thing about kids is their palates aren't bastardized. So these kids just eating them by the handful, you know, and in that moment, because they're like warheads, right? Kids love sour, bitter, astringent things. If we can get this into these kids' diets when they're little, not only are they getting the taste of food that is medicine and great for them, they're getting a story. They're getting a word. They're getting language. They're not getting the white version of growing up that I did. You know, they're starting to learn. And that, it's those sort of opportunities that I take as the oppressor or whatever to decolonize the plate of everyone in my community, everyone around me, and every opportunity I get. It's moments like that. It's using food as a tool to share story and open up a safe space for people to talk about our past.
And it's also really ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, what we're doing now is having to really harness our own granny skills. You are granny skills on Instagram. You were the original granny skills. And we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. But that is all about resilience skills, isn't it? And it's about understanding what's on the land. You know, when the chips are down and they're going to be down, whatever happens in the next 10, 20, 40 years, whatever, the chips are definitely going to be down and we're going to have to use those resilience skills. And that is absolutely entwined with the story, isn't it, of country, of garden. You gave me a gorgeous book called A Conscious Garden, which is your latest book. It's all about the same thing, isn't it? It's about getting your hands dirty and seeing what's under your feet.
100%. You know, when we talk about cuisines of resilience, I mean, this is it. This is the oldest cuisine in the world. And resilient, absolutely. Resilient from a past perspective, but this is now what we are now trying to thread back into farmers' land and into our plates to be climate resilient in the future, because it's the only stuff that we can guarantee is going to survive. You know, it's survived 65,000 years. Obviously, some of it hasn't because of colonization and because of climate change and because of what we've done to the planet. But when we talk of cuisines of resilience, then this is it. You know, we have to be thinking about climate resilience when we look at our plate. And if we ignore things in our own country that are there because they're part of the ecosystem, because they're part of fixing the nitrogen into the soil, because, you know, they're super, super human nutrition. If we ignore that, we're screwed. Like, we're absolutely 1,000,000% screwed. And we have an opportunity right now, like right now, to tip. And if we don't use our old people, and when I talk about our old people, I'm talking about our Indigenous elders. If we do not take the knowledge that they have, they are our living encyclopedias and they are going to be gone very, very soon. Our elders, like both Damien's grandparents are gone. There's not many of them left, and we are absolute assholes if we don't do something about it.
Yeah. And I love the way that you say that, you know, food is medicine, story and reconciliation. You know, when you're talking to those elders, how amazing it must be for them to finally hear that interest and that real kind of gratitude to even if it's so late in the day that you've come to say, what do we need to know about this country of ours? Is that a reconciliation that you see?
Well, yeah, we like to talk about reconciliation on the plate, but it is also a very, very complex story in that we can't just presume that because an elder has knowledge that they want to give it to us, right? We have to consider how many times people have taken First Nations people's knowledge all over the world. I'm not just talking about Australia here in context. Every Indigenous peoples that I've ever met, we have this, you know, it's the same story I hear over and over. You know, someone's got a story from an auntie about this amazing plant that can cure this and cure that, and off they've gone and taken it to a bloody lab and sold it for millions of dollars, you know. I mean, the pill, the contraceptive pill, is a prime example of something that came from Australia. It's actually the kangaroo apple. The seed was sold by a white Australian man to Russia in the early 60s or something to make the contraceptive pill as we know today, because he noticed that the kangaroos ate it at a certain time and the Aboriginal women ate it at a certain time, and then had it tested, and then boom, before you know it, you know, another piece of intellectual property has been stolen by an Aboriginal person. So it's a really complex one to try and explain in one, I guess, chat, Jilly, in that as a non-Aboriginal person, whilst we have this plethora of knowledge out there, we can't presume that we can share all of it either. So we have to, it's all about relationships, you know, and if we don't build those relationships and have that trust, you know, some Aboriginal elders are more than happy to pass down stories to anyone because they don't want it to die. And then others have been stuffed around in the past, so they don't want to. And I completely understand that. I understand both sides of the coin. So it's a really complex one.
you know, I wrote a book way back in 1998 about Australian food and, you know, the idea that I, a British person, should come over and tell the story of, or at least hold the microphone to people to tell the story about Australian food is just so hilariously 90s. It just wouldn't happen now.
Oh, it still would, Jilly.
But what I was getting was these waves of immigration, you know, the power of story around food and identity. And, you know, the Italians coming over in the 1950s, the Greeks in the 60s, the Vietnamese boat people in the 70s, and that wonderful fusion that became, you know, created the best Australian food, well, the best food in the world, actually. And with your incredible produce around just off your shores, it is, Australian food is incredibly good. And it has attracted a lot of amazing chefs into the world of food. Does that include Indigenous people?
Well, not as much as we'd like. And there are lots of reasons for that. One being, very sadly, our First Nations population, you know, is not very large, because of colonization and other factors. And two, in the native food industry, we only have about a 1-2% participation rate. So of what is, you know, a multi-million-dollar industry, that uses native foods, only about 1-2% of people are First Nations involved in that, which is something we're working very, very hard to change, with all the work that we're doing at the moment. Behind the scenes. And that is really sad. But we also can't presume that because you're an Aboriginal Australian that you want to work in the native food industry. Do you know what I mean? So we can't put people into stereotypical boxes and go, well, you must know stuff about bush food because you're Aboriginal and you must want to work in bush food. Like, do you know what I mean? So it's a bit of a, it's just one of those things.
So John Sanfrello, a Scottish guy who was the chef at Arana in Adelaide, which is very near you, he kind of was one of the first people to kind of introduce the idea of Indigenous foods on telly. Is that true?
Yeah. So he sadly passed away in April last year. So he was the judge on MasterChef for the last 5 years. This is the thing. Australia has this weird thing with, we only seem to listen when chefs from Britain come to Australia or chefs from abroad come to Australia and tell us what we should be eating, like Heston Blumenthal, you know. All of a sudden everyone was buying sausages with pepperberry in them because Heston had a range in Coles, you know. But, yeah, I mean, MasterChef as a phenomena itself. I remember in the first seasons of Australian MasterChef where there was nothing, you know, and then all of a sudden maybe one season, one person might use a token bit of bottle seed and then, you know, it started creeping in. But what Jock did when he became the judge of MasterChef was made it part of his contract that there would be native food in every single episode. And there was always acknowledgements to country at the start of every show and things like that, which were just so fantastic for an audience that large. But, you know, it took a Scotsman who came and lived in Australia for that to happen.
Let's go into some of your food moments. We were just talking about, you know, kind of getting Indigenous products on the MasterChef menus. We start with roux burger and crocodile curry. I mean, you say it's Australia on a plate. It is. It feels a bit like Crocodile Dundee. It feels almost pastiche.
Does it feel a little bit stereotypical and a little bit tacky? Yes, it probably does. But, you know, a really important food source for First Nations Australian people who live up and around coastal waterways and obviously inland waterways. So, and the beautiful thing about crocodile is it really is just like eating, you know, chicken. And it's so versatile. But, you know, it's not my favourite meat in the world because sometimes it can be a pain in the ass to cook. But what it does is it starts a conversation. And that conversation leads to a story and that story leads to language or a word and that language or a word leads to culture. And that's all we're trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember doing a story on crocodile back in 93. I was working on Channel 4's Food File and I had to go down to Brixton Market to do, and the episode was called Novel Foods. And it was about how we introduce, you know, foods that are exotic and into the kind of the menu. It had nothing to do with story. It was just about people making money out of it.
Absolutely. And people having a laugh about it, or people, the shock factor. It was shock factor, right?
Yes.
As opposed to appreciation factor.
Totally, that's it.
And that's the difference. And, you know, there's a place in Byron Market, the place that sells the ostrich. I remember doing pop-up restaurants in London where I'd had to get my crocodile and kangaroo meat from the place in Byron Market. But the difference is we're not doing it for shock factor. We're doing it for appreciation factor, and reconciliation factor.
Your second food moment is much more to do with what most of us would understand to be kind of indigenous foods, bushflower waters, and the role of fermenting and growing and collecting. And is that all part of the same story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, First Nations Australians were hunter-gatherers. They were sophisticated farmers and the first fermenters, the first bakers, the first, you know, everything you can possibly imagine. And what I started to realize as someone who loves fermenting things and loves to eat fermented foods, I started to do a bit more research and digging into it. And, you know, they existed. They existed tens of thousands of years ago. No different to what we're doing now, just in different vessels and in different forms. So the flower waters, we were told beautiful stories of flowers such as Banksias and bottle brushes and the ones that have nectar right at the ends. All you had to do is put them in a jar, cover them with water, and you got a natural flower water because the nectar is the sugar. So no different to fermenting anything that's got sugar and fruit in it. So this has been done for tens of thousands of years. And what I wanted to do by putting these sorts of recipes in the books was show people that these have been being done for tens and tens of thousands of years, that it's not a new thing, that I'm not trying to be a hipster and, you know, ferment and make kombucha just with a native ingredient. Just wanted to show the simplicity of being aware of seasons. So what the flower water thing does really is just shows you how aware of the seasons are. Because if you can beat a bird to a flower for the nectar, for something that is highly nutritious and sweet, naturally sweet, not sugary sweet, not the way we make kombucha today, but it just shows you how aware and in tune with the seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And traditional medicine is absolutely integral to eating, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about fermenting, it's the first thing I go to if I feel like I'm getting a bit of a bug coming in, some kombucha.
Yeah.
That's my automatic reaction now. I've learned that.
Yeah.
And quite late in the day, Indigenous people would have grown up on that stuff.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, just something as simple as, you know, Kakadu plum comes out before flu season hits. And Kakadu plum is the highest source of vitamin C in the world. And, you know, it was just eaten whole as medicine, you know, as a tasty little energy pop of medicine. It's sour, and tart, and has flesh a bit like an olive, but it was medicine. You know, all this stuff is medicine. And we, have gone way so far removed from eating that way. I definitely see lots of Asian cultures and Indigenous cultures still living this way. But me as a, you know, kid born in the 80s in white Australia, I'm so far remote, was so far removed from this, like so far removed that it couldn't be more removed.
Your third food moment is what you call mac lentil curry. It's macadamia, one of my favorite nuts. I first tasted them in Australia way, way, way back when I was about 21. And I just thought, oh my God, this is heaven. We can make it in the UK, obviously, because we've got macadamia nuts, but they are indigenous to Australia. I mean, all of these things we can get.
Yes.
But it's much more the story behind it that we're interested in here. Why did you choose this as one of your food moments? What does this represent to you?
Because for me, this is like a mishmash of culture. This is like lentils and curry and a native nut. And it really is one of those things that you can also throw whatever the hell you want in it and use whatever spice you want. But I also just wanted to choose this because I wanted to, you know, use something that for a very long time people probably didn't realize was Australian because everyone thought they were from Hawaii because Hawaii was the biggest exporter of macadamia nuts for, you know, 30 years or something ridiculous. And that's because, once again, we lost the IP. We didn't think it was worth protecting, which is why one of the big missions we're on at the moment is working on intellectual property and protecting some of the native foods that we haven't already lost or given to another country for nothing, and they've become the biggest exporter of it. So we're working on some technology at the moment and working on a system whereby we can protect foods much like champagne, like camembert, like the DOC system in the same way. I just wanted to put that in there so that we open a gateway for a story so that we can say, well, actually, that nut was ours and we gave the seed to someone and they grew them in Hawaii, and we're only just starting to overtake them, Hawaii again, as being the largest exporter of them.
Yeah, and that is speaking the food industry language as well. When you start talking about DOC, DOP, you know, it's oh, okay, we know that one. Yeah, great. And then we are opening the door to, you know, more on menus, more stories, more trends, more buzz.
Absolutely. You're 100% right.
Like green ants. I mean, I was quite surprised when you gave me a packet of green ants. thanks for that.
Well, look, let's not tell border control that I was bringing those into London.
I'm trying to find someone to feed them to, actually. I'm sure I'm going to get loads of comments saying, me.
Yeah. You know what, Jill, use them where you'd use coriander seeds, because that's where, in cooking, in curry paste, sprinkled on someone's yogurt, you know, next time they come over, and don't tell them what they are until they've finished, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah,
absolutely. But you do say that the reason that you've chosen this one is because it's a way to share story.
Yeah.
So actually there's much more point in telling people what they are eating before, or maybe afterwards.
Maybe just the vegans afterwards.
Maybe. I always thought that green ants were much more associated with Asian food.
Well, I'm sure they probably have their own version of a green ant, but this particular green ant is very much from a very specific part of the top end of Australia, from the Larrakia country, and it's only harvested by Larrakia people. It's not allowed to be harvested by anyone else. It's very much illegal to do so. So it's really, really special when you get to purchase something like that, because you know it is being wild harvested by the people who are supposed to do it.
You know, Australia, the story you tell is so full of story and substance and depth. It's not how Australia has been painted over the years. And actually, Australia hasn't got the best rep for being, you know, a particularly sort of outward-looking nation.
No.
How does this help Australia kind of settle into itself and become a better nation, do you think?
Well, I think what's going to happen is eventually, as Australians, we're very bloody proud of stuff, right? But it's usually sport. One day, we're going to realise that we have this wealth of knowledge and skills and medicine and food and biodiversity, and we're just going to wake up and be so bloody proud of it. And that's when things are going to change. Everyone's going to be proud of being Australian and of our cultural past and our future and our possibility moving into the future. Look, things are dreary post-referendum, I'm not going to lie. I have been very disappointed in my country, but I meet enough people on the daily basis that are fighting the good fight with me, and I meet enough people that once I explain something, their mind is like blown, a bit like mine was. So all it takes is for me and the other people that are fighting the good fight to get into enough people's living rooms or pantries, for want of a better word, to blow people's mind so that they can have their own aha moment and appreciate and champion our truly local foods in Australia.
Thanks for listening. Do head to Extra Bites on my Substack to get a taste of some of Rebecca's First Nations food. And I'll see you next week.